Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Most of us, of course, think of Justice Antonin Scalia as a towering giant of the legal community. But there's a new book out that really, I would say, shed some light on a different aspect of Justice Scalia. It is On Faith, Lessons from an American Believer. And it is co-edited by his son, Christopher Scalia, who joins us right here on the Bulwark Podcast. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Scalia. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Charlie. It's great talking to you.
Well, tell me first of all, why you decided to put this book together.
Well, a couple of years ago, we released another collection called Scalia Speaks that gathered nearly 50 speeches that my father delivered about a variety of topics, including a lot of what's in this collection. But we thought that, well, we knew that his religious speeches were so important to him, and he had actually, before he passed away, been considering a collection of just those speeches. So we thought it would be a good idea to kind of approximate the collection he envisioned and have something smaller, more accessible to people who just wanted more insight into his own religious belief and what he had to say about the place of religion in America's public square. And I said this was something he had been planning. He gave a draft of a collection, basically a series of speeches, to an acquaintance of his to read over, get some input for, and the friend sent it back to him the day before my father passed away. So we're talking about, you know, something that had been on his mind right up towards his final months, essentially. And so what we did with this collection is we included a lot of speeches he delivered about faith, and we also included a lot of his judicial opinions that dealt with religious belief and the Establishment Clause. And we also included a number of reflections from people who knew him, including a couple of his children and Justice Clarence Thomas, kind of describing what they saw about his faith and how it influenced their own and their own lives.
Your brother writes one of the introductions, your brother who is a priest, Paul, and he makes a couple of interesting points that your father, he describes your father's gruff, contrarian exterior, and that he was very sort of uncomfortable and reticent about talking about his prayer life. And in fact, he tells the story of his father telling him, you know, I pray the rosary any day, you know, every day. Do you think it does any good? And he was sort of taken aback by that because it was a little bit out of character, even given your father's very deep faith and long tradition, you know, raising his whole family in the church, to talk about his faith. So, you know, this is somebody who obviously thought, read deeply about religion, but was it something he didn't want to talk about? I mean, how...
It wasn't that he didn't want to talk about it. I think he enjoyed talking about it, but I think that he probably just didn't think people really cared about kind of his personal element, and he would personal side of his faith, and he would rather talk about kind of the more public side, kind of the argumentative side. If I can read a paragraph my brother writes, for years I have heard my father referred to as a devout Catholic. I always wince at that word, which typically describes one who comes easily to his religious practice, prays peacefully, and speaks naturally about his faith. That wasn't my father. He was indeed a man of faith and, in his own way, devout. But like everything else in life, faith had something of an argument and contest about it. After all, this was the man who, when asked by reporters about how he responds to those who question his public practice of faith, made a dismissive, misinterpreted by some as obscene, Italian gesture on his way out of Mass. I don't know how many of your listeners remember that, but I think it was 2005 or 2006. Something.
Describe what the gesture is. It's the.
Well, it was kind of flicking the top of your hand across underneath your chin. It means I don't care, but that's its primary meaning. But there's a secondary meaning that is a little bit more abrasive than that. It's funny, when we were clearing out my dad's chambers and we were looking through his bookshelves, there was a paperback guide to Italian hand gestures, and somebody, either whoever gave him the book or my dad himself, marked that page, the page of that gesture, and it said, I don't care. There's certainly precedent for that original public meaning. I think my dad liked, he liked talking about faith, but he didn't, it wasn't something he bored us with growing up. You know, he didn't, he chose his moments, and he would talk to us about prayers he really liked, for example. And we include a couple of prayers in here that we know he liked. And he would talk to us about the significance of certain points of Mass, or on driving us back from church, he would talk to us about a sermon, why it was really good or where it fell short. So it wasn't that he was reluctant to talk about it, but he didn't, he chose his moments. And as a result, when he did talk to us about his faith, it really resonated.
Your brother has a line in here. What mattered to him really was not his faith, but the faith, which I think, sums that up. And he obviously was very intellectual in his approach. I mean, the kinds of books that he read, you know, Cardinal Newman, G.K. Chesterton, C.S. Mm-hmm. Lewis. You know, if I had to name three authors that influenced me, those would be the three. Your brother also quotes from Matthew. The passage, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind," pointing out that some people make this false dichotomy between faith and reason, but your father never made a distinction, a division between faith and reason, which is very much in the Catholic tradition as well, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And he, one of his best and most beloved speeches is really on that topic. In this collection, we called it "Not to the Wise." He sometimes called it "The Two Thomases." And in that speech, mm-hmm. he kind of contrasts Thomas Jefferson with St. Thomas More. And Thomas Jefferson, kind of surprising given Dad's appreciation of the founders, is kind of the heavy in this speech because mm-hmm. Jefferson edited the New Testament and cut out all references to miracles or things that were basically too hard to believe. So,
I mean, it really is a bizarre little chapter in American history that Thomas Jefferson is sitting there with a razor blade and basically, you know, editing slash vandalizing the New Testament, coming up with a Bible that he found acceptable. But he also, in that speech, quotes Thomas Jefferson's real contempt for the Christian religion. And I wanted to ask you about that. Is this the speech, you know, Christians as cretins, basically that you have to be willing to be a fool, and that sophisticates have very long, you know, for a very long time, looked down upon religion. I want to talk to you about that because it really is Thomas Jefferson versus Thomas More. And he starts off basically saying, this is nothing new. You have the Apostle Paul who goes to Athens, yeah. and where there are all, you know, sophisticated. It's basically like going into a Georgetown cocktail party. And when he starts talking about the Christian faith, people are rolling their eyes and they're snickering at him. And basically he leaves. And then he updates that to Thomas Jefferson writing about the suspicion, I mean, the superstition of the New Testament. And it was interesting that he did talk about that contrast between the intellectual contempt for religion and the fact that Christians needed to accept that, and then contrasted that with the tradition of St. Thomas More.
Thomas More was my father's hero, and he really liked quoting him. He quoted him in many of his speeches. And Thomas More was like Jefferson. He was a Renaissance man. He was sophisticated. He was powerful like Jefferson. But my father pointed out what people forget about Thomas More is that, you know, the premise that he was standing up for, that the Henry VIII didn't have the authority to divorce his wife and that he needed the Pope's acceptance. So at that point, he was the only holdout, in large part, or at least in part, because that Pope wasn't very well liked. He's not one of the all-time great popes. So More was really out on his own there, and everybody thought he was being a fool. But again, my father pointed out, he didn't see with the eyes of the wise, he saw with the eyes of faith. So More was able to reconcile reason and faith in a way that Jefferson never did. My father delivered this speech very often to groups of lawyers who he believed needed to hear it because they were, you know, kind of ran in sophisticated circles like More and Jefferson and would kind of have to put up with condescension at best in some situations from their friends and from their colleagues. He quotes that by now infamous Washington Post description of evangelicals as poorly educated and easily led. And that's kind of the springboard for that speech. And he also points to an episode, I think it was in the mid-90s, is either in Maryland or Northern Virginia, one of the D.C. suburbs, where a priest had the stigmata. He had the wounds of Christ, and I think there was also a statue of Mary in the church that was apparently weeping. And he wondered why there weren't throngs of people visiting it. He said, I didn't visit it because it wouldn't do anything for my faith. I already believe, but why weren't tons of Post reporters, for example, going there to see if it was true?
Thomas More, the section on Thomas More, I found very, very interesting, because what he reminds people of is, we look back on Thomas More as a saint and this great leader, and he basically says, look, understand that he was very much the outlier, and most people of the time thought this was kind of silly. He said, we've forgotten how this looked. The average Englishman didn't really care about this. It didn't touch his life. The mass went on the same. You know, with all the splendor of religion, the monasteries were still in being everywhere. There was no interruption, you know, and most everybody, all of the great bodies, all the bishops except one had yielded to King, Henry. They had not yielded with great reluctance, but as a matter of course, to the ordinary man of that day, anyone, especially a highly placed official who stood out against the king's policy, was a crank. And as he points out, even in A Man for All Seasons, it's pretty clear. Even his family thought that he was nuts for not going along with this. His wife thinks, why was he giving everything up? Duke of Norfolk says, you're behaving like a fool. Why? You know, we've all given in. Why don't you give in? And he was the one guy that stood up against the political fashion of the day and didn't go along with the reigning monarch, along with everybody else.
Yeah, that's right. And he saw More also in other speeches as kind of the ultimate kind of an emblem of the rule of law, knowing that if you knock down, he has that description of knocking down the forest, that eventually the entire forest is laid clear and you're totally susceptible by all the laws you've changed for your own purposes. So yeah, he admired More very often. And there's a little story behind that. He and my mom saw A Man for All Seasons early in their marriage. I think the year after they got married, they saw a performance in London. And I don't know, I'm sure they both knew quite a bit about More before then, but that play really resonated with them. And it's kind of a touching stone or touch point for many of his speeches.
Well, I always think of that line from A Man for All Seasons where Sir Thomas More says, for Wales, why, Richard, it profit a man nothing to give his soul for the whole world, but for Wales? Isn't that the trade-off? Okay, so, inevitably, Thomas More is a religious figure. He's an intellectual figure. He's a political figure. So your father obviously cared deeply about, personal morals, about personal moral integrity, as well as a conservative judiciary, which we haven't gotten into that. But so any thoughts on your thoughts on this internal conservative debate over supporting a man, our modern day King Henry, a man of dubious morals, highly questionable character, in exchange for judicial nominations? Because most conservatives have gone along with the bishops and all of this, if you're following me.
First, I had a hunch you would bring this up, Charlie. And I'm glad you're not asking you're not asking me directly what my father would think of Trump, because that would be something I wouldn't be able to answer. But it's not quite comparable, for one thing. With Henry, it wasn't just morals; it was disobeying or going against a specific church teaching and the authority of the church itself. And I don't think that's necessarily the issue with Trump. But I think that a lot of the concerns that you voiced over the years about President Trump's sketchy history, sketchy personal life are certainly legitimate. But I don't think that means we should not support what he's done for the judiciary, which has been, I think, an unmitigated positive.
I agree with that. And this is why it's a dilemma, because obviously the judges are incredibly important, and being able to continue your father's legacy, I think, is incredibly important. But of course, then the question is, do you have to support everything? Do you have to support everything else? I mean, you know that there is this ongoing debate about. So, and, you know, like David French is making the interesting point. He says, look, you know, I understand a lot of conservatives have gone along with the lesser of two evils, and they defend the lesser evil. And then somehow that morphs into then the you know, defense of all of this behavior and an attack on anybody who doesn't go along with all of this. So I guess that's the balance for a person of faith. How much are you willing to accept in order to get other things that you want?
I do think that is an important question. And I would side with David French, on that point, that I think that being very happy about judges doesn't mean you can't criticize some of the president's other policies and personal behavior. But I think, you know, my own personal approach to this, and I think this is where I depart from you and many of our friends at the Bulwark, is that I actually did not vote for President Trump in 2016, mm-hmm. but I will in 2020, because he has been he's actually been better than I expected, particularly on judges. I don't think that there's any possibility of us doing from a conservative perspective getting anything better, and certainly not from a Democrat. So I personally, and this is, I'm certainly not speaking for what I think my father mm-hmm. would have done in this situation. I personally don't think that it's worth Republicans losing the Senate, which I know something that some mm-hmm. conservatives who dislike Trump think is something we need to do to save the party and things like that. I mean, I think that he has done enough good things that he deserves our political support. But I do agree with you guys that, I think that the president brings a lot of crazy out of a lot of people. And he brings a lot of crazy out of his the people who support him no matter what, and the people who criticize him no matter what. And I think it's important to have the approach that, you know, you'll be independent minded.
Yeah, no, I certainly agree with that. But, you know, this argument that he's done so many good things, so let's overlook all of the other things that are going on. Isn't that pretty much the argument, though, that all the, you know, the folks made? I'm sorry to keep going back to St. Thomas More. So, you know, hey, the King Henry's doing all this great stuff. We're all going along with this. And look, he's done this. He's built this. He's done all of those things. And so let's not hold him accountable for things that violate our moral code. And it isn't this sort of the ultimate definition of the Faustian bargain, in which you get all sorts of things that you want, but you're willing to say, okay, I'm going to look the other way about the lying, about the deception, about the porn stars, about the perhaps his contempt for certain niceties of the law, as long as we get these other things. Isn't that the definition of kind of a Faustian bargain, the kind of thing that St. Thomas More refused to make?
Well, I think we're talking about, I mean, I don't think we're talking about whales here. I think what we're looking at, and we're not talking about
whales, the country,
you know, Henry losing control of the monarchy either. And I just don't think that, I get the comparison you're trying to make. I just don't think it holds up, because we're talking about different critiques, and the systems we're talking about are too different there. I do agree with you that it is a mistake not to criticize a president, even if it's one you generally support, when he goes wrong. Conservatives have that responsibility. I just don't think it's quite as comparable to the Thomas More situation as you're suggesting here.
I have to tell you that for me, Thomas More has been a great inspiration, and the sort of mm-hmm. the willingness to be the contrarian. But I want to talk about the book. I don't want to get bogged down in this particular discussion, because I really did find the discussion of your father's faith to be really very, very valuable, including the whole discussion of the role of religion in society. And the question of religious liberty, which, you know, for some reason, I think some of our progressive friends do not understand how powerful this question of religious liberty is. I mean, at one time, religion was part of the fabric of our country, of our politics, of our institutions. George Washington talked about God all the time. And yet over time, we've increasingly secularized these discussions. And the courts have played a role in restricting where we could have religion, you know, when we can have, for example, you know, prayers at graduation ceremonies. And I wonder if you want to just talk about the role that the courts have had in secularizing our society, which I would argue has not been an unmitigated success.
My father was really concerned about the direction the Supreme Court took in Establishment Clause cases, really since the 1960s in particular. And as you were just suggesting, he often pointed out instances in which the founders promoted religion. They didn't promote a specific religion, but they promoted religious belief because they understood religion was an important source of virtue for citizens. Mm-hmm. And in a democracy, it was important for people to be virtuous. And given that, people, the government should promote that sort of religious expression. But more recently, the court had taken a different approach and argued that the government didn't just have to be neutral between religious denominations, but had to be neutral between religion and irreligion.
Right.
And that meant that, for example, you couldn't have a non-denominational benediction before a high school graduation. My dad wrote a dissent in that case from the early 90s that we include in this collection. Now, so that doesn't mean you have to have a benediction before a high school graduation, but clearly the founders did not, based on what they wrote and based on what they said themselves, my father liked to quote George Washington's speeches and letters on this topic, they often referred to religion and mentioned God in public addresses. So the original public meaning of the establishment of religion clearly did not forbid mentioning God or things like that on public property or at public events. And my father's concern was that the Supreme Court was basically closing off public expression of religion, and that would have serious consequences or could have serious consequences mm-hmm. for the citizenry down the road if they weren't encouraged to appeal to that source of virtue.
And the other battle line is the whole question of the conscience clauses or religious exemptions from certain government requirements, which again would seem to be in a society that values diversity and tolerance would be something that we would understand that people should not be required or businesses should not be required to do things that violate their deepest religious beliefs. And yet that seems to be one of the real flashpoints, both, well, politically, culturally, and obviously something that's going to be litigated through the courts for years now. And your father had some pretty strong views on that.
Well, one of his most controversial opinions, and one that many conservatives don't like, is we include in this collection, it's his opinion, a majority opinion in Employment Division mm-hmm. v. Smith. And in that mm-hmm. opinion, my father ruled that it was legal for the state of Oregon to fire employees who tested positive for drugs, even though the drug they used was a religious ritual. They were Native Americans who smoked peyote. And my father's argument was that the law forbidding the drug use was neutral. It was not targeting mm-hmm. the right. Native American religion. Because it was a neutral law, it was not infringing the religious exercise. However, an exception could easily be made for that certain drugs, and my father a certain drug. And my father argued that exception should be left to the democratic realm. That should be hashed out in the legislature. And that's eventually what happened. And other states with similar laws already had exceptions, and then the federal government Congress passed and President Clinton signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's come around again, as you mentioned, with a lot of these cases, religious, it's in a different court. The Sure. kind of the shoe's on the other foot now, where you have Christians making the argument that they should have these exceptions. I mean, and I don't mean to suggest that they're wrong. I think they have great arguments, but it's really interesting that my conservatives want this opinion overturned, and the left is very supportive of it and wants RFRA overturned. So it's really interesting how all that's changed over the past couple of, well, I guess we're going on 30 years now. I just want to add, my father's argument was that if you, it could lead to basically every man's conscience would become a law unto itself, and we would be courting anarchy if we recognized all of these exceptions and didn't ground the exceptions in legislatively passed laws rather than the just inferring them from the Constitution.
So another thing that I wanted to I was reminded of reading through some of your father's papers is a distinction that I think a lot of conservatives really don't appreciate, the distinction between a strict constructionist and an originalist. Strict constructionism is not the same thing as originalism, correct?
Correct. And unfortunately, this is something that not many conservatives or too many conservatives misunderstand.
Right.
And they tend to conflate the two. So strict constructionism is a very literal interpretation of the Constitution. Actually, Vice President Pence referred to strict constructionism in positive terms yesterday, but it's really not a good way to approach the Constitution because it tends to be over-limiting. Take, for example, free speech, and this is an example my father came to pretty often. If you take a strict constructionist approach to freedom of the press, or freedom of speech, then you would be okay with the government restricting all sorts of political expression, for example, handwritten notes, because that's not of a press. But originalism interprets the Constitution according to its original public meaning. And in that case, freedom of the press had a very specific meaning at the time of the Constitution's ratification that covered more than just the press. And same thing with the freedom of speech. So my father ruled in one case that drew the ire of some conservatives that laws against flag burning were unconstitutional. Flag burning is not literally speech, but it would have been understood at the time as the sort of political expression protected by the First Amendment. So that's the danger conflating originalism with strict constructionism.
Yeah, this is important because they are conflated on a regular basis, and I like the portion of your father's opinion that you highlighted, where he said, "Look, I am not a strict constructionist. Text should be construed neither strictly nor sloppily, but reasonably. And if you think the First Amendment covers only the word speech and press in the literal sense, you have to believe the Congress can censor handwritten mail." You know, he says, "Of course, the words speech and press are stand-ins for the expression of ideas, and that expression can be made through symbols and symbolic acts as well as through words. Semaphore and Morse code are covered, and so is the burning of a flag." Now, and again, this is a very, you know, this difference between strict constructionism, it's just the words, versus the original meaning. Is not just this is not just a technical difference. This is a fundamental distinction that I think conservatives need to step back and think about a little bit more.
I think you're right. I think conservatives are kind of fooled by the term strict construction because it sounds very different from loosey goosey. You know, we know that it's bad to legislate from the bench, and kind of impose your own policy preferences. That's a loose or if you want to put it, liberal or lenient approach to interpreting the Constitution. So strict construction must be good, but it's not good because it goes probably too far in the other direction. Or not even that. It's not even that it goes too far in the other direction, but it just makes a similar mistake in a different way of not approaching it according to what the document originally meant to the people who wrote and ratified it.
You know, our debates do seem to be so bogged down in some of these cultural distinctions. Well, by the way, so what do you think your father would think of a book on faith? You think this is something that he was planning on doing himself? You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, it wasn't this exact book. Many of the speeches he had in those kind of that original manuscript we do include in here, but we also included opinions, which he hadn't planned on doing, and many reflections, as I mentioned, from friends and a couple of his children, to kind of give a full perspective of how others saw his religious practice and belief and how it informed their own.
It's a great read. I mean, there's no question about it. And it reminded me, by the way, what a great writer and stylist your father was, which is not always the case among lawyers. I don't know how much you hang around lawyers and even judges, but I mean, this is really what distinguishes your father, who basically said, look, you can actually be a really good, lucid, funny, witty writer, as well as a powerful jurist. And I think that's one of the things that people are going to remember, but also be reminded that he was able to do this on a variety of different subjects. And I was really struck by that reading some of his essays.
He wrote for the public, even in his opinions. He wanted law students to read his opinions, because by the time, for example, he was writing his dissents, it was too late to convince the majority, but he could convince posterity. So he wanted law students. He was writing for that audience, and he wanted to engage them and obviously make strong arguments, but to do so in ways that were entertaining makes it sound too slight, but to engage them, to make them want to read what he had to say. But even legal opinions, even very engaging ones and accessible ones, are going to be legal opinions and necessarily dry and bogged down in notes and things like that. So I think he loved delivering speeches as much as he did, and did so as often as he did, in large part because he could just speak directly to people and be even more accessible than he was in his opinions. And that's what you mentioned, the variety of his speeches. That's one of the things that Ed, my co-editor, and I were really struck by as we edited this collection and the previous one. It's just, we knew he spoke a lot, but it didn't really occur to us how many things he spoke about. And it must have been a lot of fun for him. Well, I know it was a lot of fun for him just to speak, because I knew that he often did so when I was growing up. He was gone occasionally to do that, but I didn't realize how many different things he spoke about, and it is very impressive.
Well, there's a couple of little details that just gave me some sense of that, how his mind was always working. You know, a lot of us will go to church and our minds will wander. And in your brother's chapter, he describes how he would be, you know, intensely reading the prayers and going through the prayer book, and then would find the phrase that really jumped out at him and would share it, that he was thinking it through and he had questions in his mind. And he was always, shall we say, he described himself as a kibitzer. He was always, looking for, the point, in the sermon, was it made very well? Oh, here was the question I really wanted to ask you. So and this is again from your brother's part, that there was a phrase that he just, I think I hated, that he really disliked anytime it would pop up in a sermon, the phrase, in a special way. What was it about that that hit his trigger?
I think that's something my whole family, my whole family hates that phrase. For some reason, priests always say, in a very special way, today we, and it's just I think it's more than a tick, but it's kind of sloppy thinking. And my father hated sloppy thinking, and he hated sloppy writing. And it was just, I think in part, it was just a sign that the priest had not thought this idea through all the way. And that frustrated
him. Cliche work.
Yeah, exactly. And so he wanted his priests, he didn't expect every priest to be like, you know, Cardinal Newman, but he expected them to be pretty rigorous in their thinking. And he, you know, so he did have high expectations. And one of the things we included in this collection is a letter he wrote to a pastor who delivered presided over the mass for his former colleague, Justice Powell. Mm-hmm. And my father was so impressed by this pastor's sermon, which focused on Christ rather than the greatness of Powell himself. And my father wrote this pastor saying, you know, too often Christians seem to think that funeral masses are just about praising the deceased and celebrating the deceased ascent into heaven, but that's not really what these funerals should be about. They should be about the reminder of Christ and the salvation Christ has given us or offered us. And so my father was happy to complain about priests and pastors, but when somebody did something right, he would also make that clear too. So I love that letter he wrote, and I think it's also a good reason my brother's homily mass or homily that he delivered on my father's funeral mass is so excellent, and why my father would have appreciated it so much, and we included that in here too.
No, I mean, the one thing that readers will take away is how deep and thoughtful your father's faith was, how deep his appreciation was for the Catholic tradition, and how seriously he took the doctrines of the church. This was not somebody who was just formalistically a Catholic, but somebody who thought very, very deeply about it and really integrated it into his life in a very, very personal, very idiosyncratic way. But, you know, the books that you cite that he read, in terms of, you were talking about sloppy thinking, you know, Newman, Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, these are all very serious, rigorous thinkers who were, you know, silly, did not see this dichotomy between faith and reason. And I think that's the tradition that really shines through in this book. Christopher Scalia, thank you so much. Thank you for the book, first of all, which I found thoroughly entertaining. And thank you for the time that you spent with us today. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.